This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. This is the second of four interviews conducted between 1993 and 2014 with the late Edmund White, who died on June 3, 2025, at the age of 85. Known as the patron saint of gay literature, Ed White wrote novels, memoirs, plays, essays, biographies, and various hybrids. He was the co-author of The Joy of Gay Sex and worked extensively in the gay community during the AIDS crisis and later. This interview was recorded on September 15, 1997, while he was on tour for The Farewell Symphony, the third volume of his semi-autobiographical trilogy about his early years and the effect of the AIDS crisis. This interview has not been heard in over 26 years.
Farewell Symphony, it's clear by the end of the book why you're calling it the Farewell Symphony.
Well, the title comes from a symphony by Haydn, in which in the last movement, all the musicians get up and leave the stage one after another until there's only, actually there are two at the end, but I say there's one because I think that's poetic license, still left fiddling. And to me, that's like a very good metaphor for surviving the whole age of AIDS and going on and writing about a whole lost generation. When I started the book at the end of 92, I was nursing a dying lover, and I guess I thought that since I've been positive since 85, at least as far as I know, maybe it was earlier. In any event, I kept thinking, well, it's only a matter of time before I'll become ill too. That was all, of course, before the new cocktail of drugs, and it was before Hubert's death, which I suppose once I assimilated that death, I sort of thought, well, there's no reason I have to die. I mean, maybe it's like a kind of survivor guilt or something, or you just assume that you're on the same track as the person that you're nursing.
Well, I knew several people who were the last remaining person in their group, and yet other groups of gay men were not touched at all in San Francisco. It's a very odd disease, how it's like the angel of death passing over people haphazardly.
Well, you know, what I always find amazing is that in spite of all the millions and millions of dollars that's been consecrated to laboratory research, there's been very little demographic study of how it gets passed around and so on, and very, very little study of what particular behaviors communicate the disease. And I know, like, at the end of Samuel Delaney's book, A Madman, he has a whole diatribe in which he denounces the medical establishment for not having studied the question of behavior and how it relates, you know, which particular sexual behaviors really communicate the disease and which don't.
The Farewell Symphony is the third of three novels. Yet these aren't really novels. And the first, The Boy's Own Story, which brought you great acclaim. How close was that book to your life, and why did you choose to call it a novel?
Well, I think most people feel that that reads very much like a novel, and it isn't really very close to my experience. I mean, that is, I was somebody who was very precocious sexually and had a lot of experience by the time I was 15, whereas The Boy and Boy's Own Story has only been about the two people. And I was somebody who was very precocious artistically and intellectually, too, and won lots of prizes and was published very young. And The Boy and Boy's Own Story is rather average, in at least intellectually. And so I think I made those changes in order to create a character that I thought more people could identify with and that was less eccentric. I think I felt I was such a weirdo as a child that if I really wrote that story, it would put everyone off. In the same way, I think even in this book, The Farewell Symphony, I've simplified things enormously. Like, in the period that this book covers, I was living in San Francisco for a while. I was the editor of the Saturday Review. I was an editor of Horizon magazine. And I don't mention any of that because it seems to me irrelevant. What it really is a way of of taking certain memories that I had, simplifying them, and then reimagining them. In other words, if I really called this a memoir, people would laugh because they'd say there's no way you could possibly have remembered in such detail all those dialogues, all those exchanges between people, the precise way somebody looked, the way they moved. I mean, you would have to be somebody with an eidetic memory to come up with all that.
Do you think that the autobiographical novel, per se, like this, or Proust for that matter, is a higher or better form, or just a different form?
I think it's just a different form, but I think it is characteristically a 20th century form. I mean, Proust said we each have one novel to write, and that is the story of our lives. And I think that when people write other kinds of novels, like when somebody like Nabokov writes Lolita, people just assume that he actually liked little girls. And especially as we get more and more into the opification of our culture, everyone assumes that every book is a kind of confession, and especially if it's written in the first person. I mean, actually, Nabokov loathed Humbert Humbert, was not at all interested in little girls, and was shocked when people made that identification.
Now, you wrote a very, very long and complex biography of Jean Genet. How do you compare working on that biography, say, to working on the biography of your own life?
Well, when you write a real biography, you have to do a lot of research and sit up at a desk and consult all your notes, whereas when you write fiction, you can curl up on your bed and sort of think, and or go to a cafe with just a notebook. I mean, in other words, you're constantly taking your own mental pulse when you're writing autobiographical fiction and you're trying to evoke memories, whereas when you're doing a biography, a proper biography that begins at the beginning of somebody's life and goes to the end, and where you have to do an enormous amount of research. I had to interview hundreds of people, travel thousands of miles in order to do the work. It's very interesting, but it's entirely different. I mean, I never use the word I once in the Genet biography, whereas I use it all too often in my fiction.
In The Farewell Symphony, you or your character has certain lifestyle choices. He's, you know, at the height of the gay revolution, he is going out, prowling the streets till 3 a.m. You come up with a number of 3,120 people that, if this is autobiographical, the number of people you slept with. What I found curious is that for me, hearing that number, you break it down to three times a week, and, you know, you figure if you went out 7 days a week, then you're only batting 300, which is good, but, you know,
conservative.
I was fascinated by the fact that a lot of the material seemed to focus on that as if that were some kind of reason for the book, or that you were somehow not proud, but rather willing to talk honestly about that. And I kept thinking, well, it's just a fact of life. And beside, what counts as one of those 3,120 people? Is it somebody that you're with for 3 minutes? If you have an orgy with 10 people, is that 10? So suddenly the number became complete garbage.
No, I agree. I mean, I just said I figured that I lived between the ages of 22 and 42 in New York City, and was the period after the invention of penicillin and other antibiotics, and before the advent of AIDS. So those were really the prime years for sexual freedom, both for straight people and for gay people. I mean, I think Susan Sontag once said that there's only this 20-year window in all of human history when people could do really more or less what they wanted to sexually, at least in big cities, at least amongst young people, at least among middle-class people, you know. So, I mean, I think it's true that, like, after the invention of the birth control pill and antibiotics, and before the advent of AIDS, and with the sexual revolution of the 60s and all the other revolutionary movements going on, people were really quite free to do what they wanted. To me, it's like a total non-issue. I mean, I wanted to put in sex with the same kind of naturalness that I think had actually occurred in those years, at least in gay life. I mean, we really were quite thoughtless about it. We just did what we wanted.
There's a friend of mine who worked on an abortive book on AIDS, and in discussing it, he said that because of the lack of sanitary procedures through the sex, AIDS, or a disease like AIDS, eventually was bound to hit. And I don't buy it.
No, because I mean, there was no way of foreseeing it, and I doubt if he could have foreseen it either. Because it really wasn't it something like a slow virus coming from the animal world into the human world, and nothing like that had ever happened before in history. And so, I think it could safely have predicted in 1975 that if gays keep getting STDs at this rate, that they're going to develop eventually a virus or a bacteria that's going to be resistant to antibiotics. Although most doctors didn't even think that. They said, well, we'll just keep upping the dose.
Edmund White, you've written several essays. In fact, they're collected in the Burning Library. How do you feel about writing essays versus writing fiction, even versus writing nonfiction? Which is your favorite and why?
Well, I like fiction best, I think, because I feel that it's the one thing that I do that no one else could do. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying that it is the most personal expression and unique, whether it's good or bad. But I think that something like my biography of Genet, I think, took too long, too many years out of my life. I learned a lot, but on the other hand, I feel someone else could have done just as good a job or better. As far as essays, I think they're useful at a certain points in your life. I think it's useful to... I think there's constantly... We have a kind of very romantic view of the artist, of the writer, of the poet, and we imagine that they're totally unintellectual. But that's a peculiarly American view. I think Camus said American writers are the only ones in the world that aren't intellectuals necessarily. Whereas I think that it's useful for poets. So, I mean, I'm reading a biography of Keats right now, and it's interesting that this most romantic of poets would stop from time to time to write mainly letters or a long journal about his views on art. And he was constantly perfecting them. He was constantly rereading Shakespeare and Milton and Dante in order to perfect his ideas about what he was doing.
In the Farewell Symphony, despite what seems to be a knowledge of what's going on around you, at the same time, you never have a TV, you never read popular fiction, and there isn't much mention that you're reading newspapers either.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that one of the things I wanted to show is that that you can still get a sense of a period, even through a rather strange and distorted lens, because I was somebody who never went to Studio 54, who had never owned an automobile, who had never gone to a shopping mall, who really knew very little about America. I mean, I went right from a boarding school to a university to New York, and I mentioned how New York is a sort of monastic existence in one sense, that you decide to give up all modern conveniences, all luxury, in order to live in a hovel with lots of cockroaches running around, in order to devote yourself to the heady pursuit of both sex and art.
When you were writing the sex scenes, did you find yourself trying to just find new ways to say it? Because there aren't that many different ways to describe sex, and I guess to some degree it's all been done.
Well, I think I did find quite a few new ways, and I think that the secret of it is to not write pornography. In other words, to my mind, pornography, which is not what I do, pornography is a form of sex. In other words, people read pornography in order to have one-handed experiences. And I think that kind of writing cannot be varied. It must be formulaic. You can't use too many fancy adjectives. You have to use certain key dirty words. The whole thing is very fetishistic and very routinized. Whereas in my writing about sex, which is as often as not comic, I'm trying to describe the actual thoughts that really go on inside somebody's head when they're having sex, which could be, oh my gosh, I have this terrible cramp in my leg, or I really have lost interest in this whole thing, or why doesn't this person go away, or am I up to this, or whatever, or I've got to get up at 6 in the morning, why am I doing this? I mean, in other words, there are all these other, and then I think you can flash sometimes on the idea that this is, I love this man, I want to marry him, and you don't even know his name.
Farewell Symphony is a very sad book. There were several times when reading it, a tear came. And some of it, of course, is recognition of people I know who've died. Some of it is recognition of growing older. Is it possible to end a life happy? Because it seems that it's either a life is cut down or it kind of dribbles away.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that's quite true. And I think that's what the Buddha said, that that life is old age, sickness, and death, and that the sooner we recognize that, the better. And acquire a kind of Buddhist indifference. I mean, I still feel myself wrestling with those same themes of Buddhism that I was interested in as a child and that I think mark all of my writing.
There's a character, I don't remember the character's name, but he's very tall and very broad-shouldered, and at the end he's kind of shrivels up. And he's not in the book a lot, but there is a point where you remark on how he's finally grown up. And then at the end, just before he dies, it's like he's lost everything. It's all gone away. Do you think that's generally true of everyone?
No. I mean, this was a guy I was writing about whom I actually knew, who had been beat and tortured by his father when he was a kid. And his father was a was a high school and college athlete who had been in a terrible accident when he was in his 20s, lost his legs and lay in bed all day long drunk, and who hated this gay son that he had, who was 6'4", blonde, but kind of a nerd. And he was always calling him a nerd. And so when I met this guy in real life, he was just beginning to come out of that. He was going to the gym, he was building a strong body, and he was feeling good about himself. He eventually started his own gym. He built the St. Mark's Baths. He designed, he was a kind of designer, although he had no degrees in it, an architectural designer. And he was featured in a book about American men. There was a long essay on him in the 1970s as a kind of gay ideal of somebody who was tall, handsome, self-assured, and great. But then as he became ill, he became much, much more religious. He went back to becoming Catholic, which he had been as a boy. He came to loathe himself and everything he'd done, and there was a lot of self-hatred involved. I think it oftentimes happens. I mean, I think, how could it not happen?
Do you think the gay community is in some way more mature now than, in many ways, the straight community because they've faced so much death? I think it's impossible to be gay and 35 or more without having seen the generation just die around you.
Yeah, that's right. I think, and I see the very, very kind of handsome, weathered faces of older gay men, and I feel like they have been through all kinds of stuff and that they really do know an awful lot about life and death and suffering and survival. And if they're jaunty and gay and funny and humorous, it's sort of in the spite of all this tragedy. It's like Yeats talking about those three Buddhist monks who are in that poem Lapis Lazuli, who, though they've perceived all the tragedies of life, they're still laughing.
Farewell Symphony contains reference to several well-known people, but you try to disguise it. You don't in the case of Peggy Guggenheim and a few other people. Why is that?
Well, the people aren't by and large very famous in my book. I've known a lot of famous people in my life, and if I'd wanted to write a kind of exciting scandal book, I could have done that about real people and even used their names, since most of them are dead. And in this book, if I invented names for those characters, it wasn't to protect them or me from libel suits, but because again, most of them are dead. But again, just because I felt that I had sufficiently changed them and recreated them in my own imaginative world, that I thought they deserved a new name. I mean, a new name was a sign that they'd passed over the frontier from reality into some sort of imaginative recreation. When there are characters who are only glancingly referred to, like Peggy Guggenheim or Michel Foucault, I use their real names because, actually, you know who taught me all this was Proust. I mean, Proust does the same thing. He'll put in a character like Napoleon's niece, Princess Matilda, under her own name. But other people that are quite clearly recognized, like Charlus, who was based on Robert de Montesquieu, he's very careful to give him a new name because he's also combined Robert de Montesquieu with King Lear and Vautrin, who was a hero of Balzac, and lots of other people. In other words, he's created this kind of new artifact, this sort of golem of his own imagination, and therefore that person deserves a new name.
Did you find yourself during the writing of Farewell Symphony confusing the real people with the simulacrums you'd created?
I don't know. I mean, I'm very, very, very interested in reality. I mean, I'm very interested in checking my experiences and my writing against life. I mean, in other words, if I were a painter, I would be a realist. And if I were a composer, I'd probably write operas, because I'm very interested in human feelings and in actual experiences, and especially in the way things look. I think I'm sort of a visual writer, and I'm always trying to look at things and imagine, how would you put that in words? And I'm trying to come up with new descriptions that have never been used before. So I don't know. Sometimes, yes, I feel that even the character that's based on me, I mean, the narrator, kind of got away from me. He becomes somebody slightly different than I am. I mean, I think he's somebody who is probably more confident than I am. I mean, somebody more extroverted than I am.
He also is perfectly willing to bear his soul. Is that your soul you're bearing?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in the sense that I'm rather reserved as a person, and the same, and passages that I've actually written, when I read them out loud on this book tour that I'm doing, make me blush, because I'm not used to, I mean, it's a very different sort of thing. I suppose most people, when they write, are more reticent than they are with their best friends. I'm more reticent with my best friends than I am when I write.
I think it's fairly common if you ask a writer, who is your audience, more than likely they will say, well, me, I'm my audience. Is this true for Edmund White?
Not at all. I'm not my own audience at all. I think that maybe because I'm gay, but I think gay people are so used to judging very accurately what impression they make on other people. I mean, we're spending all of our lives either when we're young pretending we're straight, or when we're older pretending we're from a higher social class than we actually are. But I mean, we're either social climbing or dissimulating or doing something else. And I'm somebody who's always been living internationally now for so long. So in France, I'm French. In England, I'm English. And I think this kind of chameleon-like quality makes you extremely aware of the effect you're producing. And so when I write, I'm always thinking, what effect am I producing? And one of the things I've had to do, and I tried to do in this book, is to make my narrator less charming, because I feel that charm is almost a fatal problem for me as a writer, not as a person, but as a writer, and that I'm always trying to seduce the reader and make him feel totally sympathetic to me. And I think that's very limiting, because it's important to say lots of things that are actually a turnoff or unpleasant in order to be honest. I think honesty is much more important than charm.
I think you say at one point that the reader that you wanted, who you imagined, was female and living in Europe. Is that true for this book?
No more. I mean, when I said that, I was thinking of Mrs. Nabokov, and I was thinking that I wanted somebody who knew English well, who was sympathetic and open, peculiarly attuned to literary values, but who wouldn't recognize all my references if I started referring to TV shows or brand names in America. Because I find that so many American realists are what I call coffee cup realists, who just sort of think they can establish character by mentioning what kind of car somebody drives and what kind of laundromat they go to or something. I mean, it seems to me very... they don't realize that their books are going to have to be footnoted in 20 years from now, and that nobody will understand those references.
You said when we were off the air that love is codependence. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, I think that people have such unrealistic ideas about love. I mean, first of all, I think love is a kind of disease, and it brings great rewards in the sense that it makes you suffer, and suffering is probably always good because that makes you more sensitive. It makes you more alert to other people. It allows you to excavate your own soul in a more profound way. But it certainly is a kind of disease. It's a kind of unhappiness. It's not a happiness. I mean, there are two kinds of love. There's a sort of happy, cozy, domestic love that usually isn't very sexual. Then there's the other kind, which is passionate, oftentimes turns to hate, is violent, is disturbing. And that's the only kind I'm interested in. I mean, I think that's the kind that makes you feel that you're really alive, even though you're usually wincing.
Do you see any difference, say, in the way straight people, heterosexual people, relate to one another in love versus the way gay people do?
Yeah.
Let's go one further, gay men versus gay women.
Well, yeah, because I think it is probably to do with there was a famous study by Pepper Schwartz of gay couples, lesbian couples, and straight couples, and she really concluded that straight couples were a kind of compromise between what men would be if they were totally alone and what women would be if they weren't interacting with men. In other words, lesbianism and gay life provide almost laboratory pure samples of what male culture is when it's not interacting with female culture, and vice versa. But I think that what's interesting about gay male relationships is that when they're over, the men oftentimes, almost always, stay friends. Whereas I don't know any divorced couples who stay friends, and they might be civil with each other for the sake of the children or something, but that they really don't continue seeing each other or hanging out with each other. Whereas you and I both know plenty of gay men who even after they break up, continue living together.
Why do you think that is?
It's because I think that the metaphor of the best friend is the one that really governs gay male relationships, and that though you might imagine when you first start falling in love that this person is your husband or your wife, or that this guy is the beloved and so on, you might have this whole romantic vocabulary in your mind. I think very soon that person becomes your best buddy also if the relationship goes on. I mean, this is somebody you confide in that you know is in your corner. And I think just as if you have a best friend and he wants to have an affair with somebody else, you say, go ahead, do it, because you want that person to be happy. In the same way, I think it's very hard for gay men to, with certain very important exceptions, but I think generally gay men are not that jealous or possessive.
Well, you had one lover, Fox, I believe his name was, who was.
Yeah, definitely, and he was. But I think that was interesting because the character I call Fox was somebody who was an aspiring writer, and my career had already sort of begun to take off, and his had not yet taken off. And I think what he really was envious. But envy is an emotion that's so ugly that most people disguise it, even to themselves, as jealousy. They'd rather be jealous. A jealous lover is a familiar figure on the social landscape, but an envious lover, somebody who wants to have what the other lover has, whether it's reputation or money or looks or whatever, is considered slightly despicable. So I think he concealed his own envy and dismissed it as a form of, I mean, presented it as a form of jealousy.
Edmund White, you've written The Farewell Symphony, and at least it appears that there probably won't be a fourth volume unless, you know, at the age of 80, you suddenly decide that the rest of your years have filled in. What do you plan on doing next?
Well, I'm writing a 100-page biography of Proust, and in fact, there will be another volume of this because I probably will call it something else since I've called this a trilogy and it's finished. But I do give short shrift to the character Bryce or Brice in this book, and I want to write a book about him. I didn't want to tack his story on the end of an otherwise long and exhausting novel. I mean, I thought it would do him a disservice. So I want to write about my years in France, which I've also sort of neglected in this book. And I have a lot of funny things to say about France, and I want to write about that particular relationship with Brice. Then I have other books in mind. I'm doing a book of interviews with famous gay men. I've interviewed people like David Geffen and Elton John and lots of well-known painters like Cy Twombly and Jasper Johns. And so I would like to go on exploring that.
You see yourself doing any more biographies beyond Proust?
No. I mean, I might always do it if I found somebody that I thought hadn't been. I mean, I feel like I started at the top and I don't quite want to come down because, I mean, I did the first biography of Jean Genet and he is a towering figure. So it was very exciting to run around and interview all these people who had known Genet, and most of them have died since, and to sort of take on one of the most enigmatic and difficult figures of the 20th century and one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. Anybody else seems to me like a come down. I was going to do a biography of Cocteau, but then I started reading Cocteau's poetry and it's ghastly. So I thought, I don't really want to spend 7 years in the company of a writer I don't admire.
Your books have generally been very autobiographical, your novels. Do you ever get the idea of working within, say, a genre or moving in a completely different direction just to see if you could do it?
I've written lots of plays, and two of them have been done that aren't at all autobiographical. And then my very first novel, Forgetting Elena, and my second novel, Nocturnes for the King of Naples, were not at all autobiographical, really. So, and then my novel, Caracol. In other words, I think there are really two strains in my fiction. There's one that's much better known, which is autobiographical, and then there's this other one, which is fantasy fiction, you might call it, in the sense that it's not about other planets, but it's sort of a shadow world that I make up. I think Nabokov's novel Ada was my biggest inspiration.
Which is, in essence, an alternate universe novel. It's science fiction, frankly. Do you see yourself ever trying that?
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about science, and I'm not very interested in that. But I am interested, yes, in fantasy fiction of the sort that I've already written, which is kind of, I suppose, equally inspired by Nabokov's Ada and also by Kafka. I mean, in other words, Kafka writes about these sort of shadowy bureaucracies that probably reminded him of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but that we don't think of in historical context. We read it as a kind of emblem for totalitarianism or for the soul struggling toward God, or since it's an allegory, it can be interpreted many, many different ways.
In the end, do you think that Edmund White will be remembered as a gay author or just an author?
Well, I think writers, if they're lucky, get their books reclassified every 30 or 40 years. I mean, I think Kundera once said to me, Milan Kundera said, the atmosphere in which a book first emerges determines its reputation for the first 30 years, but after that it's sort of up for grabs. And I think that's true if you look at the history of literature. Like, if we were in the 19th century, we would say, you must read Zola, he's a naturalist, but don't read that terrible Flaubert, who is a realist, or that terrible Balzac, who's a romantic. In other words, there was a war between these different schools, and you felt you had to choose. Now people read Balzac and Flaubert and Zola all at once and don't even notice that they belong to different schools. There's a lot of rhetoric, I think, that is like scaffolding around a building that sort of falls away, and then the building is left freestanding, but only after a certain amount of time goes by.
Edmund White eventually wrote The Flaneur, A Stroll Through the Paradoxes of Paris, and Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris, published in 2014. He also wrote one more biography about the poet Rimbaud, Rimbaud, The Double Life of a Rebel. The character Bryce in The Farewell Symphony reappears as the character Austin in the novel The Married Man, which was published in 2000. He would also return to historical fiction with the novel Fanny, a Fiction, published in 2003. The three novels in his trilogy are A Boy's Own Story, The Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony. You've been listening to an interview with the late novelist, essayist, and biographer Edmund White, who died on June 3, 2025, at the age of 85. It was recorded September 15, 1997, while he was on tour for the third novel in his autobiographical trilogy, The Farewell Symphony. This recording was digitized, remastered, and edited on October 10th, 2025. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky radio shows on Facebook.